A lot of kids this morning, which is such a blessing. But it's just a blessing to be together and to talk about one of my favorite subjects, the joy of thankfulness, the secret of a thankful heart. Emerson said that if the stars only came out once a year, everybody would stay up all night just to see them. But they're out every night, and so we just stopped bothering, right? And that's because we get accustomed to miracles, you might say. The creation of the universe was a miracle. But we get accustomed to blessings. And as we get accustomed to blessings, they just kind of lose their fascination, and we become blind to them. Kind of like the Israelites, you know, were brought out of Egypt, and, you know, with an amazing deliverance of 10 miracles. And then they're brought into the wilderness, and they don't even have to cook for breakfast. They get manna every morning. And it's a miraculous measure of manna. But after a while, they're like, all I can see is manna. This manna is just making me, you know, weary. Our whole being is dried up. There's nothing at all except this manna before our eyes. It was a miracle every morning. But they got so accustomed to it that they eventually just got tired of it. And God ended up disciplining them to open their eyes to appreciate a miracle that they woke up to every morning. And so what you're going to see in the scriptures is that thankfulness is associated with worship, unthankfulness is associated with judgment. And you kind of see that over and over. What is thankfulness? Here is a Bible dictionary definition. What is thankfulness? Heartfelt gratitude to God expressed in response to his love and mercy. That's a dictionary definition of thankfulness. But sometimes a real-life story or a real-life example is actually a better definition. I have here a letter that was written to a congregation, a Church of Christ in Orlando, Florida. And it was written by somebody trying to find a person that had helped them years before. And she writes, "Dear sir, I'm sorry I don't know your name. I'm writing because I need help to make amends for a situation I caused in your area many years ago. The year was either the end of 1964 or 1965. I was at that time a drunken, unpredictable, undependable girl of about 25. I had been raised in the church, but I was off track by my early teens. I was in trouble. I had no money and no place to go when I reached Orlando. I called the church, and you people found me a place to stay with some fine people who helped me find a job, gave me much love and care, and I was not able to appreciate those good people at that time. But now I'd like to help in finding them so I can thank them." Now, this letter was written in the 70s about a situation that had happened in the 60s. It wasn't released. This letter didn't actually get published till the 80s. She says, "It seems as though there was a church in Winter Park at the time, but I don't remember. I don't remember their names either. So that what I've prayed for may be impossible. They were an older couple whose children had already left home. I remember I awoke one morning, and the husband had put a beautiful rosebud on the dresser. The wife was a beautiful woman who fixed lovely meals for me and tried to get me to talk to her. All I could do at the time was lie. They got me a job next door with the neighbor who had heart trouble. I was, of course, irresponsible. If you could think of anyone to help me in this search, I'd be so grateful, or anything else I can do, thank you would never be enough to give them But I could tell them that thanks to Alcoholics Anonymous and God, who did not choose to leave me in hell, I've been sober and without drugs for nearly 4 years. I work with others who are like me, trying to help where I can. I married a while ago, and we expect a baby in a few weeks. I have been given such riches of the Spirit in my surroundings, and I have been able, with God's help, to return to church for the right reasons. I'd like them to know these things, because I was ready for something terrible to happen in my life when I met them, and I believe they helped put it off. And I'll never forget the rose. The preacher ended up finding the couple, and she was able to make amends and to thank them. But this letter gets to me, because honestly, I would need to write 10 of these to the people who saw me at my worst and helped me and didn't give up on me along the way, back when I was in my 20s and teens. What is thankfulness? Is it an emotion? Is it an attitude of gratitude? Is it the power of positive thinking? I think that letter kind of describes what thankfulness is. It's a gratitude from the heart to God and His people, primarily to God. It is God's will for you to be thankful, and we know that from the Scriptures. Notice this passage here, 1 Thessalonians 5:16 through 18. Rejoice always, pray continually, give thanks in all circumstances, for this is God's will for you in Christ Jesus. This is our primary passage, but we're also going to look in Daniel chapter 6 in a moment and Matthew chapter 18. This is God's will for you, to be thankful in all circumstances. And the question is, how is that even possible? Seriously, how is that even possible? I mean, how can you be thankful in all circumstances? Are you supposed to be thankful when you lose your job? Are you supposed to be thankful for a long-term illness? Are you supposed to be thankful by being betrayed by an enemy, or cutting remarks, or hurt feelings? You know, are we supposed to be thankful in that too? Look at this verse closer. Rejoice always, pray continually, give thanks in all circumstances. It doesn't say give thanks for all circumstances. It says give thanks in all circumstances. What a difference one word makes. So, we face many life circumstances, both good and bad, but we're to have a heart of thankfulness in all circumstances, not necessarily for all circumstances, but we are to have a thankful heart in all circumstances. One person said, the soul that gives thanks can find comfort in everything. The soul that complains can find comfort in nothing. So, if we are to give thanks in all circumstances, how are we supposed to do that, even in dire circumstances? I think there's an example with Daniel. If you would, in Daniel chapter 6, we have a situation here in which Daniel is in dire circumstances. So, for example, God's people have been taken into captivity. Okay? Daniel is someone who was among the captives, one of the first, actually, to be taken captive to Babylon when the Babylonian armies captured Jerusalem. So Daniel is among hundreds of thousands of captives taken to Babylon. And talk about a trail of tears. Look at how far they were marched. Many of them chained together as captives. And they had to march all the way from Jerusalem all the way to Babylon. Jerusalem was destroyed. The holy temple of God was in ruins. And God's people are chained to one another, basically being drugged, marched, forced to and I just can't even imagine. I can't even imagine how devastated they must have felt. But in Babylon, things get worse because Daniel is forced to serve in a pagan government, in a pagan culture. He's forced to serve basically as a servant of the king. However, as you know, he was gifted with wisdom. And it wasn't long before Daniel and his friends are basically become advisors, actually, to the king. And that makes a lot of people mad. Okay? Because Daniel has now sort of leapfrogged over some of the Babylonian officials who were basically waiting for their next, move up. And here comes this foreigner, this young guy from who's not even a part of their culture, and he's now going to be over them. Okay, now Daniel's become public enemy number one to these Babylonian officials who used to be in power. Now they have to answer to Daniel. And so notice in Daniel chapter 6 what happens. It pleased Darius to set over the kingdom 120 governors, satraps, officials to be over the whole kingdom, and over these three governors, of whom Daniel was one. Daniel's now basically placed at the top. He now is one of three who answers directly to the king, and all these other guys now answer, a third of them now answer to Daniel. And over these three governors, of whom Daniel was one, that the satraps might give account to them so that the king would not suffer no loss. Apparently there was some problems going on. And the king felt like putting Daniel up there was going to maybe straighten things out. Then this Daniel distinguished himself above the governors and satraps because an excellent spirit was in him, and the king gave thought to setting him over the whole realm. Okay, this is not good. Because now the king is thinking about making Daniel second in command over everybody. And you can just imagine, this is not going over well among the Babylonian officials. And so the governors, the satraps, sought to find some charge against Daniel concerning the kingdom, but they could find no charge or fault because he was faithful, nor was there any error or fault found in him. Then these men said, "We will not find any charge against this Daniel unless we find it against him concerning the law of his God." So these governors and satraps thronged before the king and said, "King Darius, live forever." You know, and they present this trap. "King, you're just so awesome. And really, nobody should be praying, or petitioning anybody but you, because you're so awesome. And so let's just make a rule, let's just make a law that for 30 days, if anybody petitions anyone but you, awesome king, that they get thrown into the lion's den." Wow, really? I mean, they flattered him. And that's how they got it through. And unfortunately, he didn't see through it until it was too late. Because then we read in he established this decree, and we read here that in verse 10, "Now when Daniel knew that the writing was signed, he went home, and in his upper room he knelt down on his knees three times that day and prayed and gave thanks before his God, as was his custom since early days." Daniel knows that the law went through, and yet he still bows down in his room and he prays and gives thanks to God three times that day, as he's done since he was young. He gave thanks, even in dire circumstances, even knowing that it could cost his life. Isn't that interesting? Even in captivity, even knowing it was against the law, even knowing it was at risk to his own life, he prayed to God and gave thanks. That's what a thankful heart looks like. A person of faith. And of course, you know what happened. these deep state officials, the Babylonian deep state, they set it all up. They had him thrown in. They had the rock put over the entrance. They had it sealed with the seal of the king. And even the king was upset. It says that he couldn't sleep that night. And he actually said to Daniel before he got thrown in, "Your God, whom you serve continually, he will deliver you." I think at this point, the king knew this was a setup. And he's actually sorry that he signed the decree. But as they brought it back to the king, "You signed it. It's the law of the Medes and Persians, which means it cannot be changed." And they cornered him. And they had Daniel thrown in the lion's den. And of course, you know what happened. God sent an angel and closed the mouths of the lions. Do you realize Daniel in the lion's den is not a children's story? It's a conspiracy to murder, right? And yet God knew what was going on. And he closed the mouths of the lions. And when the king rose early, he couldn't sleep. He goes directly and has the stone removed, and he looks in and he says, "Daniel, has your God kept you alive?" And Daniel says, "Yes, he has. Yes, he has." And of course, the trap that those officials laid for Daniel ended up being the trap that they were thrown in, because the king knew that he had been set up. It was all a setup. And yet, even under threat of death, Daniel was still thankful to God and gave thanks, even though it was against the law. Thankfulness is a faith force multiplier that pleases God. And that is the blessing of a thankful heart. But the Bible also gives us the tragedy of an unthankful heart, because not everybody's thankful. And it creeps in ways you may not expect. And so here's a guy who was forgiven a massive debt. Jesus tells us this story of a man who had a massive amount of debt. And you might wonder, you know, how could somebody have this massive of a debt? It's like more massive than he could pay in 100 lifetimes. And some people look at that and they're like, that's not realistic. When you look, though, at what we just read about with those Babylonian officials, think about somebody with that level of power. Think of a bank executive with that level of access. And they think that they're going to take this money and they're going to put it over here and it's going to gain a whole lot of money. And then it falls apart and they lose it all. There are situations in which somebody has access to unreal amounts of money and they end up losing it because of their carelessness or their selfishness. Sometimes you'll hear about it on the news. A young bank manager just flat out loses $1 billion because they basically gambled it on the market and it didn't go the way they thought. Maybe they put it in a hedge or something. Here's a man who had a massive debt he couldn't have paid. In Matthew 18 and verse 21, then Peter is asking, "Lord, how often shall I forgive my brother who sins against me? Shall I forgive him up to 7 times? And Jesus says to him, I don't say up to 7 times, but 70 times 7. "Therefore, the kingdom of heaven is like a certain king who wanted to settle accounts with his servants. And when he had begun to settle accounts, one was brought to him who owed him 10,000 talents. But as he was not able to pay, his master commanded that he be sold with his wife and his children and all that he had, that payment may be made. Then the servant therefore fell down before him, saying, 'Master, have patience with me, and I will pay you all.' Then the master of that servant was moved with compassion, released him, and forgave him the debt." He knew that this guy, it wasn't going to be able to pay this debt off in 100 lifetimes. It was a loss. But he could have sold this man and his family into some indentured servitude and made him pay it back, which he never would have been able to, but he could have spent the rest of his life working it off. But the man falls down and he just begs for mercy. And the king actually has compassion. And he just completely forgives the entire debt. Verse 28, but that servant went out and found one of his fellow servants who owed him 100 denarii. And he laid his hands on him, and he shook him by the throat, saying, pay me what you owe. And the fellow servant fell down at his feet, and he begged him. And he said, have patience with me, and I'll pay you all. But he would not. And he went and he threw him into prison till he should pay the debt. The roles got completely reversed. This guy was on his knees begging for mercy. And the king forgave him. Now another guy's on his knees begging for mercy. And he throws him into prison for owing him $100 compared to $100 million. So when his fellow servants saw what had been done, they were very grieved. And they came and told their master all that had been done. Then his master, after he had called him, said to him, you wicked servant, I forgave you all that debt because you begged me. Should you not also have had compassion on your fellow servant, just as I had pity on you? And his master was angry and delivered him to the torturers until he should pay all that was due to him. So my heavenly Father also will do to you if each of you from his heart does not forgive his brother his trespasses. That's the tragedy of an unthankful heart. It's a case study, really, if you think about it. It's a case study. Unthankful people are unhappy. Did that seem like a happy person to you? Choking somebody on the street? Unthankful people are unhappy people. They're also unforgiving. He was just forgiven a massive debt. Now he's not going to forgive this guy? Unthankful people are also unkind. Talk about unkind, throwing this guy in prison for doing far less than he did. Unthankful people attack others rather than face their own failures. They're going to attack others because they don't want to admit wrong. And unthankful people are selfish. They lack any sympathy for other people. And unthankful people are not honest. Because they're not being honest with themselves. They're not being honest with God. And they're focusing on what they lack rather than what they have. There's an old proverb, who does not thank for little will not thank for much. Kind of similar to what Jesus said, if a person isn't faithful with little, they're not going to be faithful with much. Well, if a person isn't going to be thankful with little, they're not going to be thankful for much. Thankfulness, a lot of people don't realize, is the secret to happiness. People are just now finding this out, although the Bible has been teaching it for centuries. And that's what's interesting, when a study comes out and actually catches up with what the Bible's been saying for centuries. I mean, here's a thankfulness study. It was done by researchers from UC Davis Medical Center and the University of Miami. And they said that thankfulness is the forgotten factor in happiness research. I always find it fascinating when science catches up with the Bible. And they're admitting that this previously, no one researched thankfulness. It was in the realm of faith. And so they didn't really talk about it. But what they did, they took a control group and they divided them into three groups. And they did this for 2 months. And of these three control groups, the first group was to take and have a daily journal, and they were going to write everything bad that happened to them every day. And so they had to keep this daily gripe journal, basically. Listing all the negative things in their life, all the disappointments, all the wrongs, all the hurts, all the frustrations, daily. The second group were to either not even keep a journal or just write whatever happened. The third group had to keep a gratitude journal. And they could only write in this journal the six things that was good that happened to them each day. Six things every day of just positive things. Now, before they did the study, they did brain scans. They did the brain imaging, and then they did interviews. At the end of 2 months, they did the brain scans again, and they did interviews. In the first group, the fight or flight area of the brain, and I forgot what it's called, amygdala or something like that, whatever that is, the fight or flight area of the brain, the area where anxiety, stress, anger, and fear are, it was enlarged and inflamed on the brain scans. In the second group, there was no change in the brain scans. In the third group, that fight or flight area of the brain had reduced and the feel-good part of the brain had grown. They changed their brains in 2 months, is what they found, just by thinking about the good things that were happening in their life versus thinking about the bad things that were happening in their life. And when they did the interviews, they found that the first group was more fearful than 2 months before. They were more depressed. They were feeling more hopeless. The second group, there was no change. In the third group, 2 months later, they were happier, they were more positive, they were more energetic, they were more thankful. They were able to change their brains in 2 months. And here's what the researchers said. Gratitude blocks toxic emotions such as envy, resentment, regret, and depression, which can destroy our happiness. It's possible to feel, it's impossible to feel envious and grateful at the same time. I remember Jim telling us that story. He was so upset with this boss that had it out for him, and he just came home every day grumbling about his boss. And Nadine, after a while, Nadine's like, "You're beginning to hate your boss. You have hate in your heart for your boss. You need to start praying for him." And Jim's like, "Why would I pray for him?" But Jim, having the wisdom that he had, he knew she was right. And he said, "I learned something. You can't pray for somebody and hate them at the same time. It just doesn't work." And it's the same thing here. You can't feel envious and grateful at the same time. And so the third group felt better, slept better, had more energy, had more positive enthusiasm. And here's where I found something interesting. I used to think that it was happy people who were thankful. Happy people are the thankful ones. It's the opposite. Thankful people are the happy ones. It's not happy people who are thankful. It's thankful people who are happy. That's how essential thankfulness is. It's the secret to happiness. I mean, it's one of the main components. We're not going to say it's the only component. But I want you to know it's so important that the peace of God is only available to a thankful heart. I mean, look at what Paul is saying here. Be anxious for nothing, but in everything by prayer and supplication with thanksgiving, let your requests be made known to God, and the peace of God, which surpasses all understanding, will guard your hearts and minds through Christ Jesus. The peace of God is available, but it's not available to the unthankful heart. Thankfulness is a part of what he's saying. Be anxious for nothing, pray about everything with thanksgiving. And then he says, think on these things. Remember how that study was talking about focusing on what was positive rather than what was negative? Well, what does Paul say? Finally, brethren, whatever things are true, whatever things are noble, whatever things are just, whatever things are pure, whatever things are lovely, whatever things are of good report, if there is any virtue and if there is anything praiseworthy, meditate on these things. The things which you learned and received and heard and saw in me, these do, and the God of peace will be with you. Isn't that changing your brain? when you start focusing on what is good and what is true, and what is setting your mind on things above rather than on things below. Some translations say think on these things, meditate on these things. That word meditate is, when we think of meditate, we think of Eastern meditation. Eastern meditation is emptying your mind of everything. Biblical meditation is filling your mind with truth, i.e. God's word. So, big difference there. This is, what did Paul say? Do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind. And that's how we do that. But it's not always easy. And this is the beauty of a thankful heart. You might have heard about Corrie ten Boom. She wrote a book called The Hiding Place because she survived the concentration camps. What had happened was Betsy and her sister Corrie were arrested and sent to the notorious Ravensbrück concentration camp. It was north of Berlin. All because their family was hiding Jews in Holland after the Nazi occupation. And so the whole family basically was sent to the concentration camps, and it wasn't just to sit there. These were work camps. They were forced to work hard labor. They slept on, they were in Barracks 28 in Ravensbrück camp. They slept on straw that was full of fleas. They actually smuggled a Bible into the concentration camp, which was a miracle in and of itself. And they have to work all day in these slave work camps. They only have morning and evening a break. And so what happened was they would pull that Bible out in the morning and in the evening. But in the evening is when the other ladies would gather around. And they were stuck in the back of the barracks. There was one light bulb back there, and it was the only way they could read a Bible. And so what happened was they're back there and being bitten by fleas, and Betsy says, how can we live like this in such a place? And Corrie looks over and realizes Betsy's not asking her, Betsy's asking God, how can you expect us to live like this? Being bitten alive, eaten alive by fleas in this work camp run by Nazis. Corrie realized that her sister was praying and asking God. And then Betsy, who had just been praying, says, God gave us the answer. And Corey's like, what do you mean? And she says, we read it this morning in that passage you read. And she's like, what passage? They go to 1 Thessalonians chapter 5. And they look up the passage. And in the passage it says, encourage the disheartened, help the weak, be patient with everyone. And Corey's thinking, this it's almost like this is written for Ravensbrück concentration camp. But Betsy says, no, keep going. Rejoice always, pray continually, give thanks in all circumstances, for this is God's will for you in Christ Jesus. And she said, that's it. That's how we can survive, by being thankful in all circumstances. And Corey's like, wait a minute. Wait, how are we supposed to be thankful in this circumstance? And Betsy says, well, we're assigned here together. They put us here together. And Corey says, yes, that's true. And she says, and we have a Bible. We have a Bible. And she said, yes, okay, yes. And she says, and we're not alone. There's other women here in the camp who want to hear a word of the Lord from the Bible, and they're with us. And she said, yes, okay, all right, but what about the fleas? How am I supposed to be thankful for the fleas? Well, Betsy didn't have an answer. But the next day, a guard is supposed to come back into the barracks in order to either bring them something, but they wouldn't do it. The guard wouldn't go back to the back of the barracks. And somebody asked why, and they said because of the fleas. And then they realized the only way they were able to have Bible study every night with the ladies was because of the fleas. The fleas were actually keeping the guards from coming into the barracks. And it allowed them to have this prayer group and this Bible reading group with these ladies. And this one light bulb, the only light bulb that they could even read, was in the back of the barracks where all the fleas were. And this is why, Corey said, Barracks 28 at Ravensbrook became known as the crazy place where women have hope. They had a living hope. Hope in the midst of darkness. Hope in the midst of persecution. Hope in the midst of unimaginable evil. And they began to believe and to know there is no pit so deep that God's love is not deeper still. That's what Corey came to understand. She says, there is no pit so deep that his love is not deeper still. And one of the passages that they clung to was at the end of Romans chapter 8, who shall separate us from the love of Christ? Shall tribulation or distress or persecution or famine or nakedness or peril or sword? Yet in all these things we are more than conquerors through him who loves us. Corey was able to survive. Betsy didn't survive because of her health. Corey was able to survive to tell the story. Just because our life doesn't seem good in the moment doesn't mean it's not going to be good in the end. Because God is going to make it good when we cross the river, when we can be with him forever. This is the peace that surpasses all understanding. Let the peace of Christ rule in your hearts, since as members of one body you were called to peace, and be thankful. You might think thankfulness is like some chore that we should give God, when and that is, it is true that we should be thankful to God, and yet he gives us this blessing, which is the secret to happiness, of being truly having a thankful heart for what God has done for us, actually gives us the peace that surpasses understanding because of what he's done for us. And it's just countless. You couldn't count the number of blessings. And if you ever reach a night where you can't sleep, try counting your blessings, because you won't be able to run out and you'll probably fall asleep trying. Right? Victor Hugo says, go to sleep. God is awake. He will be there for you, and he will take care of it for you. If we can help in any way, please let it be known as we stand and as we sing.